Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to the New Books Network. I am your host, Stephen Sakevich. In this episode, I will be interviewing Jason Bell on his book, Cracking the Nazi Code, The Untold Story of Agent A-12 and the Solving of the Holocaust Code, published by Pegasus Books in 2024. Jason Bell is a professor of philosophy at the University of New Brunswick. Jason Bell, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you very much, Steve, for having me on your show.
We always like to begin our interviews by asking our guests, tell us a little bit about yourself and what's the story behind writing this book?
Sure. I am a philosopher at University of New Brunswick in Eastern Canada. I have an interest in the relations between pragmatism and phenomenology, two philosophical schools. That's what brought me to Winthrop Bell, MI6 secret agent. So in 2008, I was finishing my dissertation. I was looking at the American pragmatist Josiah Royce, and I kept on thinking that his philosophy sounded a lot like the German phenomenologist. There wasn't any particular obvious reason how this could have been the case. They never met. So I decided to take a trip to Göttingen in Germany, where Royce had been a philosopher in the 1870s and where phenomenology was founded several decades later. I thought maybe I could find a book that they had read in common or something like this. But instead, I found a doctoral dissertation written by one Winthrop Bell, completed in 1914 on Josiah Royce, directed by Edmund Husserl, the founder of phenomenology. So that was an astounding discovery, linking these two fields of philosophy. But the dissertation at Göttingen was missing two pages. I found that Bell's papers were housed at Mount Allison University in New Brunswick, but they were under restriction. So I wrote to the president of Mount Allison and asked for permission to go in and research for those restrictions to be lifted. The president agreed. I subsequently learned that was after the Foreign Office had agreed to lift the restrictions. I went in and right away I saw that Bell had been an intelligence agent for the British after World War I, but at that moment, that was the less interesting fact for me than Bell's philosophy work at Harvard and other places. So I put that aside for several years until around 2012, when I began reading these intelligence reports, and then I saw that Bell had been the first to warn against the Nazis. And so that was when I changed the trajectory of my research a bit to look more at the intelligence angle and a bit less at the pure philosophical angle.
So yeah, this is a very exciting story of Winthrop Bell, forgive me, aka Agent A-12, as he was called by the Foreign Office, correct?
That is correct.
Yeah, so what was his personal background? Like, what do we know about his early life?
Sure. So his father was a prominent businessman in Nova Scotia. So he ran a ship outfitting business. So ships would come into Halifax after a long sail across the Atlantic. And of course, they would need all kinds of things, food and water and repairs. And so the Bell business was about getting the ships back out to sea. So Bell's father was well connected, friends with future Prime Minister Robert Borden. Winthrop had a role in running the family business, but his main interest was in academic work. So he received numerous advanced degrees. He got an undergraduate degree in mathematics and then a history master's degree at Mount Allison, then went and got a history master's at Harvard, and then went to Cambridge University in England to receive his PhD, but health issues with his lungs caused his doctors to send him out of England. So he went to Germany, and that's where he met the founder of German phenomenology, Edmund Husserl, and got to work on that dissertation.
Now, could you give, I know this is a complex topic, but could you kind of give our listeners a brief overview of what phenomenology is and Edmund Husserl, what was his significance to the field?
Sure. So before phenomenology got started, philosophy had largely been divided into two camps. So there were the German idealists who were obsessed with pure reason, logic, rationality, and then the British empiricists were directed towards feelings. And each side thought the other side was ridiculous, that the idealists saw the empiricists as missing out on the true dignity of the human person. The empiricists thought the idealists were making things up. Phenomenology came about as a reconciliatory position. So they saw that human intelligence works both through pure logical categories and through feelings. So it was a simple kind of marriage, but it was something that brought to an end a lot of strife and struggle. Edmund Husserl, Bell's professor, was the leader of this movement. It was seen as a way of getting back to what the phenomenologists called the things themselves. So the German idealists, the British empiricists, had been caught up in how we know things. The phenomenologists wanted to get back to evidence about the world as we can actually know it.
And how did Winthrop Bell get involved with this? What was the origins of his interest in this field?
Well, he had been studying philosophy and intended to get a philosophy PhD and eventually go to work at Harvard University. He had good connections there. He had been studying in Leipzig in 1910 when he came across a review of Husserl's work and decided that Husserl was the person he needed to be with. And that was a common kind of feeling in Germany. It was phenomenology was almost something like a religious revival. After a couple of centuries of really being, caught in navel gazing, what's going on in our own heads, phenomenology showed this way to get back to reality again. And so Bell responded with alacrity. He moved as quickly as he possibly could, got to Göttingen, impressed Edmund Husserl, and Edmund Husserl took him on as a student.
Now, when he was finishing up his dissertation, World War I breaks out in 1914. What was his reaction to that, especially since he's Canadian, British, almost, and yet he's in Germany and the two countries are about to go to war?
Sure. Well, so he was a British subject. So that was at a time when all Canadians were British subjects. He had a prominent circle of friends at Göttingen, including a math professor whose family was deeply connected with diplomacy. And everybody was telling him that World War I was going to be a short, quick war between the Austrians and the Serbians. The Austrians were going to give the Serbians a bloody nose as revenge for the assassination of the Archduke Ferdinand. That was going to be the end of it. And then things were going to go back to normal. So Bell was actually nervous as the war kicked off. And this was just when Serbia and Austria were involved, but Britain was not yet involved. But he had a meeting with this friend of his, the one with the diplomatic connections, and his friend calmed him down. No reason to be paranoid here. So Bell decided to stay in Göttingen and finish his dissertation. He was nearly finished at that point. He just had a few last revisions to make. So he was hard at work on that. As things began to heat up towards the end of July, he began to carry his passport with him, to carry money with him. But when the war actually broke out between Britain and France, actually, excuse me, when Britain and France became involved, several days beforehand, the Germans had requisitioned all passenger trains for the war effort, so there was no way he could get anywhere. So he was stuck there even before the war broke out. When the war did break out, he was arrested quickly within several hours.
And you tell this very interesting story how while he's in prison, he actually is able to still take his final exams. Edmund Husserl actually visits him in prison. Could you tell us this story?
Yeah, so Bell's committee, it was a psychologist, an economist, and Edmund Husserl, the philosopher, marched off to his place of detention to conduct the examinations. And there was a sense that Bell wasn't really super, super, super prepared at that point. He would have liked to have had more books and more time to do this. But his examiners knew that things could turn a lot worse. So at that moment, Bell was imprisoned in Göttingen. That was within reach of the committee. So they acted while they could, hurried him through the examination, and he did quite well. So he passed with honors, but then the university was scandalized by the fact that this committee had decided to promote an enemy citizen. This made news throughout Germany. The contender of the extremist press was that this was a betrayal of the German cause to promote an enemy citizen. So the university itself had a debate about...
Hold on, your audio's out.
So the extremist press in Germany published these announcements that Göttingen was promoting an enemy citizen. This was scandalous behavior. The university got together and held a vote about this. They actually had a trial. Winthrop Bell was represented by the president of the university, who was a friend of his. And so a compromise of sorts was reached where Bell's PhD was withdrawn. He did not receive the official PhD title, even though the committee had decided to promote him. But for Winthrop Bell, this was a grand success of sorts because he had been being faced with capital charges that could have resulted in his death. And the charges were instead routed to academic charges. So the worst the university could do was take away his PhD and not execute him as the nation could have done.
Now, later on, because he was still in prison throughout all of World War One, but he got involved with what was called the Ruhlenbein University. What was that, and how was Bell involved with that?
So German universities were at the time among the world's leading universities. So there were a lot of prominent intellectuals who went to Germany to study. Another figure it was John Cecil Masterman, who ended up doing important work for MI5 during World War II. But many others were there doing academic research, lecturing, etc. And so when World War I broke out, all the British subjects were arrested. They were sent to this camp. For a while, everybody was atomistic, depressed individual. They had nothing to do other than bemoan their loss of freedom. But after a couple of months, the prisoners decided to pull themselves together to create a cultural life. So some of this was supported by wealthy prisoners who wanted to enjoy culture. So they funded the construction of buildings. They had a YMCA. They converted the grandstand of Ruhlenbein prison camp, which had been a horse racing track before the war, complete with gambling facilities. They decided to convert that into a university. Winthrop lectured there on subjects as diverse as philosophy, history, and engineering. Those credits at the university, so this was a highly organized endeavor. There was a central planning system, a registrar, lectures on all fields of human knowledge. Later on, Ruhlenbein credits were recognized by prominent British institutions. A lot of the prisoners who were there, who had been members of the British working class, were able to get university degrees and went on after World War I to be able to get prominent positions within the British system.
Now, while he's being in prison, how was Bell able to keep up with events that were going on during the war?
Well, he was an avid reader of the press. So these would have been German newspapers he was getting. Now, these were propagandistic. But even still, he was able to get valuable clues out of this. So, for instance, in the first days of the war, Germany's Schlieffen Plan had made it possible for the Germans to make a rapid advance towards Paris. The newspapers were reporting about the triumphant successes on the Western Front. A couple of weeks later, Bell noticed they were making announcements about triumphant successes on the Western Front, but suddenly the Western Front had moved to the east by some dozens of kilometers. So Bell was able to tell how the war was going, even looking through the propaganda, seeing through the smoke and mirrors. So that was part of it. Another part of his awareness of what was going on came about because of his choice to have studied it at Göttingen. So Göttingen was the most prominent university in Germany at that moment for math and physics. He had befriended, and this was in large part because he had a mathematics and physics background. he had befriended promising graduate students and young PhDs at Göttingen. Among them were the founders of quantum theory. So he had innocently befriended these people just because they were, you know, they were interesting folks. But when the war broke out, those Germans were recruited into German military intelligence. So Bell had access to the people who knew the very most about what was going on. These tended to be liberal Anglophones who appreciated Britain, and they loved Bell and trusted him completely. And so he would have visits in prison with these German military officers, where he was able to get an unvarnished picture of what was going on in the country. He was also able to converse fluently in German with the guards, who would also give him a sense of the morale of the nation. He was able to detect, for instance, as the German guards themselves were having a hard time getting food during the German famines. This was caused in part because of bad harvest, in part because the farmers were being recruited into the war, and in part because of a very effective Allied food blockade of their ports.
Now, how did Bell react to the end of the war, and of course, especially the fall of the Kaiser, because that, of course, was a major event in Germany at that time in 1918.
Yeah, so he was actually at Ruhleben. This was on the industrial outskirts of Berlin, and so Bell saw the revolutionary sailors staging for the invasion of Berlin right outside the prison. So that was where the rail line went. So he had really a firsthand view. At the same time, these intelligence friends of his were coming in and briefing him on what was happening. And so he really had a privileged inner picture of what this looked like at a time when, for instance, the German newspapers were not saying anything about it. They were still portraying a united front that was about to defeat Britain. So the Kaiser fled the country. The militarists who had led the war fled the country. And Bell was for a couple of weeks in Berlin during this revolutionary period. He would go out and meet his friends, including these intelligence officers for meals and for coffees at cafes while they would listen to the gunshots in the distance of the revolution. The sense that Bell got during these couple of weeks there was that the German people were ready, hungry, and greedy for the democratic experiment. They saw that, you know, Britain had triumphed. They saw that their own leaders had been lying to them throughout the war, and they wanted to become a democratic nation that was friendly towards Britain. And so Bell, in those couple of weeks after the war ended, saw that this was nearly unanimous. There were extremists on both sides, on the left and the right, but they were marginalized. The vast majority of the people, despite the fact that they were desperately hungry, still starving, wanted to make friends with the West and become democratic.
Now, Bell actually came, based on these assessments he made, he actually came up with a certain proposal for a post-war settlement with Germany. What was that? And also, how did he, because he actually met with the, I believe, Prime Minister of Canada to propose this, didn't he?
That's correct. And so this is something I think owed a lot to Bell's background in business, which involved finance, his father's role in Nova Scotia politics. So he thought about politics, finance for a long time. While he was at Ruhleben, he was already sketching out these ideas for what a post-war peace could look like. So his plan, which in my book I argue ultimately became the Marshall Plan after World War II, he was thinking about how to provide financial aid to a defeated enemy so that they could get their industrial capacity back to work again, so that they could employ soldiers who were going to be decommissioned from the military. So this was a huge problem in Germany. There were millions of soldiers who were being decommissioned from the military at the exact moment that German industry completely collapsed. He saw that this was going to be an enormous problem, And that those soldiers would be recruitable into militias if they did not have productive jobs. Meanwhile, the government, the new democratic government, wouldn't be able to function without tax revenue. So he saw a kind of a neat and easy way to rehabilitate German industry, which would be Britain would lead an effort that would bring in both the victors, but also neutral nations to provide credits to German industry. So these credits would eventually be repaid with interest, but that would make the British investors rich. It would make the industrialists rich. It would get the former German soldiers employed again, and it would produce tax revenue to fund the German government. So Bell pitched this to Robert Borden when he got to London in November 1918, and Borden responded quickly. He supported this proposal and decided that Winthrop Bell needed to become an intelligence agent and advance Bell's name to the relevant authorities in Britain to get him that position.
Now, a major figure that helps him along in British intelligence is Captain Mansfield Smith Cummy. Now, who was he and what was his significance for Bell?
So Mansfield Smith Cummy was the founder and the head of MI6. So he was the man first known as C. He had some quirky behaviors, among them writing in green ink, that all the C's since then have followed. So, you know, if you get a letter in green ink, sign C, that means it's from the chief of MI6. So he was an adventurous fellow. He would show up on espionage missions himself in foreign countries carrying a concealed sword. He liked to live dangerously, and he liked his agents to live the same way. And so he interviewed Bell at a time when the Foreign Office decided that they needed to decommission a lot of MI6's work abroad. It was too expensive. And so the Foreign Office offered Bell what amounted to a desk position, analyzing intelligence coming out of Germany. Bell refused. He wanted to go into Germany, where things were very dangerous at the moment. And that was the kind of kind of spirit that C appreciated. So C backed him on this. Canada backed him on this, and eventually Bell got his way, that Britain would actually send him into Germany rather than trying to employ him in London.
Now, he was actually, you talk about this in the book, but Bell was able to connect his intelligence work with his previous academic work with phenomenology. Can you kind of explain the connection or how he made that connections between the two?
Sure. Well, a couple of key features of phenomenology. One is that in order to be able to see things accurately, we need to get over bias. And so this was a long and rigorous procedure for phenomenology to try to extract ourselves from all this bias that we face. And this was something that Bell did when he went to Germany. So the bias that existed among most of the British intelligence was that the Germans were a nasty warlike people who needed to be humbled. And Bell saw that. The Germans that were still in the country were actually Anglophone. They wanted a democracy and friendship with the West. There were German militarists, but for the most part, they had fled the country and were living in neutral nations and were trying to recreate their powers. So even as the British press was, after World War I, was coming out with this massive propaganda effort, about how the Germans needed to be punished in order to, in order to make them better or whatever in the long run, Bell said that was a false picture. The reality of the situation was far different from what the newspapers were portraying. Another key part of phenomenology is its attention to intentionality. So what people are trying to accomplish through their actions. So this is about, of course, analyzing words, but it's also about seeing, where the words are pointing to. What are the implications of people's arguments? And again, there Bell saw that even as the British hierarchy was paranoid about German militarism, whether it was the nationalist variety or whether it was the communist variety, that the people that he was talking to in the new democratic government just had no interest in another war. They really were interested in strong, stable government and friendship with their Western neighbors. So I try to make the argument in the book that that phenomenology was implicit in Bell's work. He at one point made it explicit in one of his reports. He used some kind of phenomenology language. He talked about describing the things themselves, which was the kind of famous rallying call of the phenomenological movement. But in phenomenology's interest in evidence and how reason can obtain evidence through combining information with verification through different sources, phenomenology really provided him with the right model for intelligence analysis.
Now, it was also during this time that he had his first encounters with the Nazi movement, or what became the Nazi movement. Could you talk about this?
Sure. So Bell, in his very first report, intelligence report, in November 1918, he gave Robert Borden the surprising news that there had been a takeover of the German government in the latter years of World War I by a group of racists who fought World War I as a race war. So this was a race war designed to destroy the Slavs. So to Borden, this was a considerable surprise. He, in turn, handed this off to the British War Cabinet that included the British Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, people like Winston Churchill, the generals who had just fought the war. And this was this kind of first awareness that there was not just a political, but also a racial dimension to the war. Now, at that moment, this is not yet the Nazis as we know them. They were just nationalists. They were not yet socialists. That group went into hiding in neutral nations, and over the next several months tried to rehabilitate themselves in Germany through a well-funded propaganda. But Bell was reporting that this propaganda was having no effect, no influence. That the German people just hated the nationalists. At that moment, there was a growing sympathy to socialism. And the nationalists saw the same thing. So in April 1919, Bell gave the first intelligence report about the birth of Nazism. And of course, Nazism was not the term the National Socialists themselves used. They called themselves the National Socialists. Nazism was, or the Nazis were, a kind of a slur used by their opponents. But Bell in April 1919 said that the nationalists and elements of the socialists had gotten together after a series of battles in March in Berlin, where the nationalists had gotten the upper hand, and the leaders of this racist movement, Ludendorff among them, realized that in order to take national power, they would need to co-opt the socialist movement. So that was the birth of National Socialism. It was the placement of national in the first position was no accident. The nationalists were going to be in charge. But they would use the well-funded machinery of socialism in order to be able to make another world war. And at this point, they were already negotiating with the Russians at the highest levels to form a cooperative agreement to eventually be able to take over the world in the next great war.
Now, also during this time, there was a lot of street fighting, particularly in Munich, but elsewhere, even in Berlin, between the communists on the left and what were called the Freikorps on the right. These were the right-wing militias of some of the ex-soldiers who were more sympathetic to the nationalist cause. How did Bell assess this situation? Because this was kind of bringing Germany almost to the point of a civil war, or in many cases, literally so.
Absolutely. So Bell made a point. So there were millions of these men who had been decommissioned. They were not ideological, but they were desperate. So they wanted food because Germany was starving, and one of the very few places you could make money was through fighting in one of these militias. So Bell's reports, and he was reporting from the scene of the fighting in Berlin. So he was actually experiencing these march battles between the extremist movements. And he talked to soldiers on both sides, the right and the left-wing movement. And his reports were saying these are the same people. They're not ideological. They're simply
fighting for these militias because they want bread. When they shoot at each other, they're not even trying very hard to hit each other. They're only aiming when their officers would walk by. So the group that were actually ideological were very small. So these were the people who were arranging the funding of these movements. The nationalists were getting money from industrialists and the great landowners. The socialists were getting money from Russia. And so these battles were going on, but there were a lot of people who were sitting on the sidelines. So during these Berlin battles, there were a lot of these socialists who did not join the fighting. They simply wanted to see who would win. And the idea was they would eventually join with the winner. So the ideology was real. The people who were actually interested in making Germany a socialist country or a racist country were actually there. But Bell was pointing out these were very small groups, even though they were able to command hundreds of thousands of fighters. The ones who actually were profiting from this were a very small group.
And also at the same time, Germany is kind of facing this internal turmoil. There's also tensions on, because Poland declared independence right at the end of the war. In fact, literally the same day that the war ended, November 11th, 1918. And this also kind of caused a little bit of tensions between the newly independent Poland and Germany, particularly around the city of Danzig. And how did Bell assess this kind of situation between the Polish and the Germans?
Sure. So Poland became a great cause of the Western powers, that this was going to be a place that was going to help create a buffer zone between Russia and Germany, help to end some of these interminable wars that had been occurring. And so the Western powers were heavily invested in the success of Poland, and yet it was very difficult for the West to support Poland militarily, given the distances involved. So Bell was privy to the Versailles Treaty negotiations as they were happening, and he knew that, for instance, Danzig was going to be declared independent because this was David Lloyd George's project. He knew that David Lloyd George, Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, knew that if Danzig went to either the Germans or the Poles, there would be a big fight for it, so he would make it neutral. But the Germans and the Poles did not know what was going to happen. So they remained suspicious about Danzig getting handed off to the other party. And so hundreds of thousands of troops were being prepared for battle on both sides, both the Polish and the German side of the border. And this was going along with the Silesian question. This was among Germany's richest industrial lands were slated in the draft treaty to be handed over from Germany to Poland. So Bell knew that either of these could be the cause for an outbreak of war. Either if Silesia was handed over to the Poles just by fiat, or if either the Germans or the Poles became convinced that Danzig was going to be handed over to the other side. So Britain sent Winthrop on a mission into Danzig to convince the mayor that Danzig was going to be neutral rather than being handed over to the Poles. And at this moment, when both sides were preparing for battle and urgent wires were getting fired from Warsaw back to London, talking about the war that was about to break out, the mayor of Danzig released a proclamation after meeting with Bell, saying that the British could be trusted, that Danzig would actually be independent. And immediately the warlike preparations ended. So Bell helped prevent a war that was in fact entirely preventable just by sharing the intelligence about what the Allies intended that up until that moment, the leaders of Danzig had been clueless about.
Now, how did Bell's career in British intelligence eventually come to an end during this time?
So Bell, throughout 1919, his warnings became more and more urgent. So I'd mentioned in November 1918, he said this group of racists are marginalized, they're virtually powerless, they have money and they have weapons, but they don't have any political power. By April 1919, He said that this group was going to be this group, the extreme right wing, had become the strongest militarily in the country. By the end of 1919, he said politically they had become the strongest group in the country. So his final reports in 1919 said that the anti-Semitic group, the National Socialists, were strong enough that they could seize control of Germany whenever they wanted. And time was running out to be able to do something about it. Democracy was becoming weaker and weaker. There was still a sliver, bit of hope. If Britain could go in and help disarm these extremist militias and provide massive funding to prop up democracy and to end the extremist threat. So there's evidence that among the highest levels of the British political hierarchy, he had converts, including David Lloyd George, the prime minister, of trying to make this happen. But he was blocked by figures in the Foreign Office who, for different reasons, did not want Germany to be rescued. And so Winthrop quit. He quit MI6, but it was a cordial breakup. So he had a kind of an end of service tea with Mansfield Smith coming, with Stuart Menges, who would become the head of MI6 during World War II. And with numerous other figures who would lead the fight against Nazism. He maintained contact with these people and his intelligence sources through the years. So he no longer was getting paid by MI6, but he would write occasional intelligence briefs to tell them about the rising Nazi danger through the 1920s and the 1930s.
Now, what was his academic career? Because after quitting MI6, he went on again trying to continue his academic career that got interrupted by the war. And so what was his academic career like after retiring from the intelligence?
Well, so he became a professor at Harvard University in the 1920s. So he innovated the phenomenological method in North America. This is now one of the largest philosophical methods in philosophy, and its effects are felt well outside of philosophy as well. Bell was the linchpin in getting this off the ground. And he was there at Harvard for, I believe, 6 years, and then retired and went back into the business world.
Now, one of his academic colleagues who kind of appears throughout much of this story is Edith Stein, who also has a very interesting intellectual trajectory and academic career of herself. And then also she later becomes canonized as a saint in the Catholic Church because she converts. Could you tell us a little bit about her and what was Bell's friendship with her?
Yeah. So Bell was actually introduced to Edith Stein through Edith Stein's cousin, Richard Courant. So he was a math PhD, math and physics PhD at Göttingen, one of these people who became a military intelligence figure during World War I for the Germans. So he was friends with Winthrop. He was friends with Edith, of course, his cousin. And he suggested they should get to know each other. Of course, also, Edith Stein was a philosopher who was working on her dissertation with Edmund Husserl. So Edith Stein helped pioneer the field of philosophy called empathy theory or Einfühlungstheorie, which is about how individuals and communities interact with one another. So she, after World War I, became one of these pro-democratic politicians. She was a source of Winthrop, so they would travel together. And she would give Winthrop briefings in 1919 about the state of the politics in Germany. After World War I, Germany was still along with a lot of the rest of the world a sexist country. It was hard for a woman to make her way as a professor. So in the Standard Academy, so she became involved in Catholic higher education and a feminist theorist. And interestingly, as the Nazis rose to power in the early 1930s, her writings were among the first to describe how the National Socialists were kicking women out of the workplace. So that was creating German babies bias of the German high command at that point was to try to get women out of the workplace and making young Aryan babies. And so she was warning against this. She was, as you mentioned, a convert to Catholicism, but she was Jewish and was persecuted by the Nazis. She was protected for a long while by her Catholic order. But eventually the Nazis, in order to punish the Catholic Church for speaking out on behalf of the disabled people who were being killed by Nazism, the Nazis lifted their protection for convert Jews and began executing them as well. So she was killed at Auschwitz.
Now, with the rise of the Nazis to power in 1933, Bell actually makes a trip to Germany in 1934. And in some ways, he's probably thinking, well, I kind of told you so. But what was his trip and what was his assessment of Germany in 1934?
Well, so Bell spent a lot of his time in 34 with one of his top German intelligence sources named Wilhelm Runge, who was at that moment innovating German radar. So Germany at that moment was far in the lead in radar design. And Runge was head of research at Telefunken, which was one of the German companies that were leading the charge. So Runge had been an officer in the German military. Then he went to this work for Telefunken, which had been owned by Jews. But when Hitler took over, the ownership was rearranged so that Aryans would own the place. Runge and other leading engineers with Telefunken were disturbed by this. They could also see how their work was being instrumentalized for a military buildup. So Bell was able in 1934 to get a sense of what their trajectory was of the Nazi movement that was very different from what the Nazis were publicly proclaiming. So we can sometimes lose track of just how in the 1930s Hitler and his leading officers were pretending that they were pacifists. They just, you know, wanted to help defend, the bullied German people who were minorities living in other countries. The notion, and this was really what supported appeasement, was that, Hitler just wanted to stick up for these little guys who were getting, beaten up, but there was no interest in war. But what Bell was seeing in 1934 was that there was a trajectory towards warlike preparations. This was far beyond Hitler trying to protect Aryans from being bullied. This was the plans for the next great world war that he had warned against in 1919.
And how did he react to the outbreak of the Second World War?
Well, he was ready for it. So the day that the war broke out, he had he sent letters to his intelligence contacts both in Canada and in Britain, offering his willingness to be taken up again into the intelligence services. At this point, he told the folks in Britain that he hoped to be able to work in Canada. He was getting on in years a bit. Eventually that's what happened. So he was eventually taken up into the intelligence services in Canada. It took several months for this to happen because Canada was really just totally shocked and surprised by the outbreak of war. Things were in real total disarray for a while. But eventually he began doing intelligence work for Canada. From what I can tell, it looks like he was going to be offered the job as the chief of Canadian intelligence. So basically, he would have been MI6's C if he had wanted to be. But he turned down that job because he wanted to play a more active role in actual rearmaments. So he wanted to help build the machinery that would actually be fighting the Nazis in a way he thought the time for intelligence had already passed. I say that a bit facetiously. He knew that intelligence was still going to play a role, and he on a pro bono basis kept on helping out with that. But by 1939, he saw that it was, you know, primarily going to be the work of brawn rather than just brains at that point to bring down the Nazis.
Now, how did he assess Hitler and Nazi war aims? Because he made a lot of intelligence reports about this, didn't he, during the Second World War?
He did. So in 1939, so this was the spring of 1939, he issued a series of intelligence warnings that went to his friends, certainly in American Canada, and I strongly suspect in Britain as well, saying that Hitler's ultimate war aim, along with his leading lieutenants, was going to be the racial extermination of all non-Aryans everywhere on Earth, followed by peace. And so Hitler, in proclaiming that he was peaceful and he wanted peace everywhere, Bell said, well, it's not exactly a lie. He ultimately wants peace, but Hitler thinks that that's going to happen once all the non-Aryans have been exterminated. So Bell warned a Canadian government minister of this. He warned his friend Francis Dayok, who became a key figure in the U.S. State Department about this. This was the earliest warning by far that the Nazis intended worldwide racial extermination. So this was spring of 1939. The next did not appear in intelligence files until 1941. At the same time, in the spring of 1939, Bell realized that this was, you know, bigger than just secret intelligence. It needed to go to the public as well. And so he sent them to set these warnings to newspapers throughout Canada. But his report was roundly rejected. Nobody would publish it on the grounds that people thought Winthrop was making things up, that there was no chance that Hitler was actually intending the Holocaust. When the war broke out, people rethought this issue of Hitler's aggression, and Bell's warnings were finally published in November and December 1939. The next warnings that appeared about the Holocaust in the English language press did not occur for another 3 years until 1942.
Now, what was Bell's later life like after the Second World War? Did he go back to academia?
He became what I guess what we call an independent scholar. So He could have easily been a professor if he'd wanted to be. He could have easily taken a prominent position in politics or in business if he'd wanted to. But Winthrop had carefully calculated just how much money he would need to retire, and so he did that. So he went back to his retirement and he lived off of dividends, so that he could pursue independent intellectual work. And so this involved some articles in phenomenology, but his main project was histories of Canada. And so in particular, he wrote a massive book on the Protestant settlement of Canada at a time when the kings of England were trying to displace French power. It was kind of a replacement that involved some elements of genocide to try to get rid of the French Catholic influence. Bell's book, The Protestant Settlement of Nova Scotia, is still a standard work in the field, regularly cited 7 decades after it was published.
So what's kind of the legacy of Bell's work in intelligence in your view?
Well, I think the main thing is that he gave warnings to people, including Winston Churchill, that made Britain nervous about Nazi intentions when other people were not nervous. So there was a tendency of people from America through France and other nations to take Hitler at his stated word of thinking he was a pacifist. Who simply wanted to reintegrate German populations into Germany, and he wanted nothing more than that. So there were all kinds of approaches that were being made by these racist military intelligence figures to Britain about cooperation agreements in order to get rid of the socialists in Germany to help fight communism. There's evidence that there was sympathy in British military intelligence for these right-wing approaches, But the powerful people that Bell had convinced shot down those approaches, and Germany remained nervous. And of course, the Battle of Britain was a close call. But I don't think it could have been won if not for Bell having, given the warning to MI6 in particular, and including Stuart Menges, who became the head of MI6 during World War II. And then I make the argument in my book that Bell's friendship with Wilhelm Runge, the chief of German radar, or one of the chiefs of German radar, was also central intelligence work in decommissioning, or at least undermining, the Nazis' most powerful new weapon. If the Nazis had radar and the West hadn't, World War II could not have been won. So in terms of both the preparation for the war and this ability for Britain to be able to get on board the radar game, I think what Bell did was absolutely crucial. Now, that's in terms of history. I think in terms of what we can do with this today, I make the argument in the book that Bell's post-war plan should become a standard model. So we need to be thinking not just about winning the war, but what the post-war period is going to look like and how it is that we can turn former soldiers into productive citizens rather than terrorists. And we've seen this again and again in places like Iraq and Libya, that if there is not a good economy in place, and terroristic financiers are the only ones who are hiring, that's what young men are going to do. And then the situation quickly devolves. So even as the war plans are being put into place, we need to be thinking about the peace plan that's going to follow as part of the war planning.
Yeah, as the saying goes, you can't just win the war. You also have to win the peace, as the common term goes.
Exactly.
This has been a very fascinating discussion. Do you have any final thoughts? Maybe touch on anything in the book that we didn't cover?
Well, I just like to say that, there's so much written about World War II. There can be a sense that everything is known about the war and the conflict, but there's a lot that's out there that has not yet been written about or talked about or discussed. And some of that is because you can find these things in private papers, in these various archives. So I think, kind of the great subtext of my book is about the importance of public archives. And in this day of people's obsession with, computer models and AI models, et cetera, there's something to be said for, actual real pieces of paper that can only be discovered by actually, going in and finding them. And we need to fund, public archives and the archivists who can help us, find this information.
Well, we always like to end our interviews by asking our guests, what are you working on now?
So I'm actually working on a project that came out of the Winthrop Bell book. So I'm writing on a U.S. operation during World War II, the spring of 1944, to convince Adolf Hitler that the D-Day invasion was going to be coming through Hungary and the Balkans rather than France. It was a wildly successful operation. It tied down something like 500,000 German troops in the southeast corner of Europe while the D-Day attack was happening on Normandy. But for various reasons, it's become forgotten.
That's very interesting. Maybe when you write that, we can have you back on the podcast to talk about it.
I would be delighted. I will 100% be glad to be here.
Yeah, because I know that probably would relate to somewhat, because even Winston Churchill wanted to attack more through the Balkans and the South rather than through France. I know that was a major discussion at Tehran and with FDR and Stalin about what was there going to be their grand strategy.
That's exactly right. And so all these battle plans, and also in the south of France, the British military had come up with plans. And so when the deception operation came around, they had convincing plans. They were able to feed the Germans. So this was not just slapdash. It was well worked out attack plans that were handed over to German military intelligence, and they looked utterly convincing. And Hitler was just completely fooled. So even when weeks after the Normandy landings happened, up to like 6 or 7 weeks afterwards, Hitler kept his troops in places like Norway and in the Balkans, because he was convinced that the Normandy attack was a deception operation, that the real attack was going to come elsewhere.
Well, that'd be very fascinating. We'll definitely have to have you back on the podcast. Jason,
I look forward to it, Steve.
Yeah, Jason Bell, thank you for joining us on the New Books Network.
Thank you very much, Stephen, for having me on your show.